Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I am your host, Monica Hadley, and with us today is John Chu, author of The Subtle Art of Folding Space. Now, John is a microprocessor architect by day, a writer, translator, and podcast narrator by night. His fiction has appeared in Boston Review, Uncanny, many other places, and his translations have been published in Clark's World, the Big Book of SF, and other venues. He's been a finalist for all the big prizes in science fiction, the Hugo, the Nebula, etc., and won the Best Short Story Hugo for The Water That Falls on You from Nowhere, and the Best Novelette Nebula for If You Find Yourself Speaking to God, Address God with the Informal You. The Subtle Art of Folding Space is his first novel. Welcome to Writer's Voices, John.
Hi. Thank you for inviting me.
So tell us a little bit about what this book is about, because it's kind of not easy to describe.
So I have to preface this. I have to preface this with back in September, Tor sent me to the New England Independent Booksellers Association conference, where I met with a bunch of independent booksellers. And the thing that I had to do was pitch my novel. And then what happened was that I was so bad at it that people kept coming up to me and saying, pitch me your novel, because I was so entertaining in how bad I was at pitching my novel. So that's the caveat. I'm really, you would think that I would be good at this by now, and I really am not.
So
the conceit is that that every universe has something called the Skunk Works that generates the physics of that universe. And then there's this nesting Matryoshka doll of universes where each universe generates the next one in. And consequently, there are these people called maintainers whose job is to make sure that the machinery that keeps the universe running keeps running, because otherwise there's no universe. So at a start of our novel, my main character Ellie, she's not in a great place. Her sister tries to assassinate her on the regular. Her mother is in a coma, and it turns out that weird things are happening in the universe. Like the definition of the kilogram is suddenly unstable. Like we don't know how much, we've lost track of what a kilogram is. So she has to go into the Skunk Works to figure out what is happening. And she finds a device that is intended to keep her mother alive. Now this goes against everything that this group of maintainers stands for, because you don't pervert the laws of physics for your own personal gain. And then while it might be keeping her mother alive, it's also causing other weird things to happen in the universe. So she does what she knows her mother wants, which is she removes this device. And in doing so, she sets off a chain of events that is going to have to force her to confront her past. You know, this entire group of maintainers who put that mechanism there for a reason. And at the end of the day, she has to decide between honoring her mother's final wishes or saving the universe.
Okay, how do you make that choice?
So I have not managed the sort of the pithy elevator pitch yet. Like this has to be a very tall building, because
absolutely. Okay. So where did this idea, is this something that you just came out of whole cloth, or where was the initial thread of this idea?
The initial thread is actually, weirdly enough, has absolutely nothing to do with any of this. This novel is an outgrowth of a short story that I wrote called Whole Time Violations. And the initial threat and the initial impulse for that was Okay, so Boston, there's a public transportation system. There's a subway that's called the T. Like the red line, the end of the red line is called the LY station. And then for a while, I needed to go to LY station to take the train to go to Boston. And I would basically always just miss the train. No, actually, this is funny because this is actually the excerpt that I'm going to read. But I would basically always miss the train. But whenever that happened, the announcement on the announcement on the PA would always be that the train is just arriving, and so for me that was the seed. That's for me that incident. The fact that it kept happening to me. Wait, hold on.
It was saying you had missed the train, but the announcements were saying that the train was just arriving.
Yes.
But you had already missed it.
Right.
Okay.
Right. So basically everything was just sort of out of sync.
Okay. Okay.
And that happened to me often enough that I'm just like, I can probably get a story out of this somehow. And then so I wrote that first scene, and for a while it was just that one scene. And then, you know, and then I read about the definition of the kilogram. And this is a real thing. For a while, the kilogram
was
this
chunk of metal. Okay, all right, so tell me, what is the definition of a kilogram? Yeah.
Well, at the time, they've changed it.
Oh.
But then this is a real thing, is that at the time, the definition of the kilogram was this hunk of platinum alloy that weighed however much it massed, that was the kilogram. And then so there was this platinum hunk of platinum alloy, and there were a couple of duplicates. And there was a stretch of time when the international prototype kilogram, the actual definition, and its clones did not weigh the same.
Okay. And how did that happen?
The mundane answer is it's probably due to wear and tear. Because the reason that they found this out is because every once in a while you take the kilogram out of its temperature, out of its hermetically sealed temperature controlled environment, you wash it and then you weigh it. And then they do the same thing with all three, and then and it's probably something, like probably some of the metal rubbed off or something. Actually, I'm not sure.
But it was
kind of this mini crisis for a bit that the kilogram and its clones didn't weigh the same, and then obviously I wasn't going to go with the mundane reason because in real life the actual definition of the kilogram was never unstable. But that led me to think about, well, what if the kilogram actually was unstable? What if there was a stretch of time where we just didn't know what the kilogram was? How could that happen? And then so that was one strand of it. Another strand of it was this was based very much on my own experiences. I'm dealing with the death of my mother. It's a different disease in the book than in real life because my book is not real life, but for a long while my mother was in a coma, and my sister and I had to make the most agonizing decision ever. It was hard, but it was a case where my sister and I absolutely agreed that we both knew exactly what we both independently realized, like neither one of us had to convince the other one of us, which I think was a great relief to both of us.
That
we both knew exactly what our mom wanted. And then that's what we did. By the way, as I'm talking about my mother's death, the book is actually pretty light and it's a fun read. That is true. It's not depressing. but it does have this thread running through it. So part of it is that. And then part of it is And then part of it is that there's a throwaway comment in the Feynman lectures about physics, where he talks about how in the early 20th century, the physicists like feel like they had basically solved physics, like they understood how the universe worked. They had like this model that predicted everything, and then they discovered quantum phenomena. So I thought it would be fun. So I thought it would be fun to work in the counterfactual. What if quantum phenomena just didn't exist until the beginning of the 20th century?
Oh wow!
And then what are the situations? And what would you have to do to make that situation happen? So those are like some of the threads that like for me, like when I write, it's never one thing. It's like seven things all kind of bound together.
Okay, so you obviously have a pretty great understanding of physics.
It's okay.
Well, more than me, put it that way. So tell me a little bit about your science background.
Okay, I have a PhD in computer well, the full thing is electrical and computer engineering because of the school that I went to. But I basically concentrated on the computer part of it. So I have a PhD in computer engineering. That's the short answer. There was also a stretch where I spent more time in the music school than the engineering school. But
okay. instrumental music?
I played violin for a long time.
Okay.
At university it was mostly singing.
Oh.
I did get recruited to play in the university orchestra, and one of the regrets. But I should point out that that's not really a big deal. It's like the conductor recognized that, oh my God, there's this person who plays violin who's not in my orchestra. I need him in my orchestra, because if you're a music major, like your major organization requirement is like one or two semesters. So if you're like a serious, serious violinist, you're probably in orchestra for about as long as you have to, and then you leave. And I was not a music major, so I didn't, you know, I should point out that being recruited to play the university orchestra is not a big deal. Like, it just meant that I knew how to play the violin. But I will say that one of the regrets is that I ended up not doing it, and I kind of wish, like violin is actually one of the things that I wish I kept up. Mm. So instead I'm teaching myself guitar, which has been interesting. But mostly in terms of education, it's been, you know, I followed a relatively traditional engineering path, except that there's like there's also this vast amount of music.
Okay. So is all of the physics in The Subtle Art of Folding Space true to our universe?
Oh God, absolutely not. Let me put some bounds on that. For the most part, the stuff that we know is perhaps accurate enough. And then there's all sorts of stuff that we don't know. And well, if we don't know, I can sort of make it up.
Okay. I mean, then, I obviously not the like getting into the skunk works and all that. I wasn't talking about that, but just like the rules of physics that they're operating under.
For the most part, the rules of physics that they're operating under in our universe, because they go to other universes, because that's what happens. What happens in our universe, for the most part, is plausible with the caveat that it is explicit that the skunk works isn't working properly for reasons, you know, I mean, the plot kind of hinges on the fact that the skunk works is not working properly for reasons that I can't reveal because I want you to read the book. physics itself is not quite working right.
Right. Is that possibility that physics would like quit working in our in the real world?
Probably not. I mean, we well. Although I don't know if it would matter because we would probably all be dead. But But yeah. So that's one of the things is that it is sort of explicit in it is sort of explicit in the novel that the world that we start in is more or less this world, but not quite.
Do you believe that there are multiple universes?
Do I believe that there are multiple? I don't know whether it matters whether I do or not.
It might not. No, it doesn't matter.
But,
I'm just curious.
I think if there is, I don't know that we can ever reach them. If there is some other universe, I don't know that we ever get to visit. So,
this concept of the multi-universe and that every decision that you make creates a new universe. I just find that sort of like, it would be so, there'd be so many. It would be just so huge. Mm-hmm. I find that hard to, it doesn't make sense to me, I guess, in a way. It's nice to think that for major decisions that there's some universe where you made that you went took the other decision and got to live out that life, but for every little thing, like,
sure,
yeah,
yeah, anyway. Right, you would have lots and lots of universes, absolutely.
There'd be so many. But John, I'm going to ask you to read a little bit from the book early on, because I feel like to really discuss it we need to get a feel for the story.
Okay, so the bit that as it turns out, it's surprisingly hard to find 6 to 8 minutes of my novel that actually makes sense. So I'm going to read you chapter one, which I think is probably a little shorter than that, but it's chapter one, which has the advantage of me not having to explain anything, because
perfect.
It's the first chapter.
Yes.
Okay. Attention passengers, the next red line train to Alewife is now approaching, echoes off the walls. Not only has the next red line train to Alewife arrived, but its passengers have already flooded the station, a torrent rushing up the escalators, through the turnstiles and down the concourse to spill out the doors to Cambridge. The deluge arriving as the PA system squawks catches Ellie off guard. It's rush hour. When a train arrives on one side of the platform, the one on the other side leaves seconds later. She sprints, a beleaguered salmon racing against the tide of bodies. Her pack slashes between her shoulder blades, a sloppy fin batting the waves of the people surrounding her. No one has tried to kill her today, yet. Her sister, Chris, arranges something at random intervals. It's to keep Ellie sharp, Chris claims, because occasionally skunk work isolationists try. Not that Ellie believes Chris has her best interest at heart. Well, not anymore. But she doesn't know how to stop the attempts on her life, and they do keep her sharp. Maybe the mistimed announcement is part of today's attempt. She'll be caught in the riptide of bodies. A wave will overwhelm her, and a shark hiding in the swell will tear her to pieces. Compared to the attempt with the Mylar balloons, the jar of Marmite, and the U.S. men's Greco wrestling team, an ill-timed flood of people at Alewife Station is downright practical and likely. Mm-hmm. None of that happens, though. The crowd flows around her as she plunges down the stairs towards the platform. The car doors shut just as she reaches them. While the PA system blasts, attention passengers, next red line train to Alewife is now arriving. The train clatters away. The train supposedly now arriving sits already emptied on the opposite side of the platform. It beeps as its doors slide shut. As the crowd streams up the stairs and escalators, the platform quickly clears, leaving a couple of people who must have, like Ellie, just missed the train. Some guy wearing shorts that stretch across his thighs, no shirt, and more self-possession than Ellie thought possible, hovers in front of one of the train doors. Someone else sits on a bench, staring at her e-reader. A thin woman reaches for Ellie like a drowning person reaching for a buoy. Her luggage crashes to the floor. She asks in rapid Mandarin whether Ellie knows how to get to the Best Western. Her oboe-like voice skips through her words. Ellie blinks. Strangers start conversations in Mandarin all the time at school. Not so much outside school. The Best Western is only a short walk away. With luggage, though, the woman will want a taxi, and there's almost always one dropping someone off outside the station. All the woman needs to do is go up the escalator and cross the concourse. She tells the woman all of this in Mandarin. Ellie's response does not draw laughs. Her irrational fear whenever she talks to a stranger in any language that's not English. In fact, the woman thanks her. Ellie decides she is not today's assassin. The woman doesn't turn to the escalator. Instead, she freezes for a moment, then glares at Ellie. People randomly start sounding like her sister way more often than Ellie would like. Some people text, her sister commandeers convenient strangers. It's never less than creepy, and it always catches Ellie off guard until the glare. If you quit school after mom's diagnosis like I told you to, you would have moved back to DC. The woman speaks in fluent English, her voice now husky and incongruously casual. You wouldn't need to worry about missing the Amtrak now. It's not Chris's voice, but it absolutely is. A childhood in Taipei clashed with an adolescence in Buffalo to give Chris an accent that's all non-rhotic and flat nasal vowels. She's always sounded like a panhandler in 1930s New York, albeit one who made unreasonable demands on her life rather than begged for a nickel. After mom was diagnosed with glioblastoma, Chris became a 1930s New York panhandler who's always promising to send Ellie to sleep with the fishes. Chris has always treated Ellie like this. Ellie was mostly through her undergrad when she had even an inkling anything was different. None of her university friends had older siblings who talked to her like this. Granted, their older siblings are just only a couple of years older, not practically a decade. Still, the idea that Ellie became a full-grown adult before realizing this is too embarrassing to think about. So she usually doesn't. Even if I miss this Amtrak, it's not like there won't be another tonight. What do you have to tell me that's so urgent that I can't wait until at worst tomorrow afternoon? Ellie folds her arms across her chest. You did not waylay some random stranger so you can talk to me about missing the train. As Ellie says this, it strikes her that maybe Chris did. The obvious opening to needle Ellie is right there. However, whatever Chris does it, though, she is, of course, always just kidding. The woman only comes up to Ellie's neck. She glares down at Ellie anyway. Of course not. What do you think I am? The woman folds her arms across her chest. If I have to stay at home to visit mom, you have to go to the Skunk Works and repair the physics of this universe. Mom brought you with her so many times that you have to be dense if you can't make a straightforward repair by yourself. Ellie ignores the jab. When Chris doesn't have to play the good, dutiful daughter around witnesses, Ellie has to ignore a lot of jabs to get through a conversation. What's the problem? Everybody's wrong about why the international prototype kilogram is losing mass relative to its official copies. We'd see divergences between them, even the kilogram would define by something more substantial than a cylinder of platinum alloy. The notion of the kilogram itself has become unstable. Ellie frowns. Fundamental physical constants are changing. Yes, now the good news, there's good news, is we found some hold time violations in the Skunk Works, probably caused by some leaking valves. They must be why the kilogram's unstable. Fix them, and I promise you I won't judge you when you don't get here until tomorrow afternoon. First time for everything. By first time, Ellie isn't sure whether Chris is talking about repairing the Skunk Works by herself or not judging her for being late. Probably the former. She's only ever assisted mom, albeit more times than she can count by now. The Skunk Works generates a universe within the surrounding universe. There are an infinite number of Skunk Works and universes. Nothing in the Matryoshka doll that is the set of nested universes can prevent Chris from judging Ellie. She would ask, but Chris is already gone. The woman turns around as though she hadn't said a thing. She goes to the escalator, trundling her bike luggage behind her. At least someone gets to go where she wants to. Ellie doesn't. Chris won't let anyone else stay by Mom's side. Mom lies comatose at the end stage of glioblastoma, on a bed in Chris's den. She needs constant attention from Chris the way dolphins need tax advice. However, taking care of your parents is a filial obligation, and no one is more Taiwanese than someone who no longer lives in the motherland. All of the relatives see Chris as the good daughter, the dutiful daughter. Even though Chris wants Ellie in the same house as Mom, she never lets Ellie do anything. Ellie visits every weekend anyway. She does because she's more like Chris than she likes to admit, just as stubborn and also someone who no longer lives in the motherland. Also, once in a while, Mom shifts in bed. She yawns. Her eyes open a crack, and for a moment, she stares right at Ellie, as though she is about to wake from her long nap. Then her eyes close again, and she slumps back into oblivion. This seems like much more than the random firing of neurons in a brain about to die. Ellie, even though she knows better, can't help thinking that the next time might be the time she wakes for real. The train beeps, its doors slide open. Passengers stream onto the train. Ellie shakes her head clear, then joins them. Everyone else is headed towards Davis Square. Ellie, on the other hand, is headed towards the universe that surrounds this one. She blends into the crowd so no one notices when she disappears. And that's the end of chapter one.
And that was John Chu reading from The Subtle Art of Folding Space. Explain the title to us.
Okay, so the title was kind of a saga. There was a stretch of time when my editor, whom I love dearly, and it is responsible for some, you know, for asking me questions that turned into some parts of this novel that are now my favorite parts of this novel. However, she was also pitching titles at me that I just absolutely loathed, and I was pitching titles at her that she absolutely loathed. I mean, which is fine. And my agent, who I love, who I also love dearly, came up with a bunch of proposed titles. And The Subtle Art of Folding Space was the one that everyone loved, and what it references is that throughout the course of this novel, people are generating status reports. People are saying, this is how I'm going to show you this model of how this universe works. And then they are all sort of these planes of folded space. So to a large extent, this novel is about, well, one thing that this novel is about is how we is we're referencing sort of this way of communicating, like how the universe works.
Okay, so I'm having a little bit of a hard time picturing what folded space actually looks like.
It's supposed to be a bit surreal. My reference was cubism.
That's kind of what I'm seeing in my mind. Yeah.
So whenever I describe all of the folded spaces, what I'm describing are you're seeing things that you're seeing something because what I decided was that it was reflective. So what you're seeing when you're looking at it is you're actually seeing the rest of the room, but from multiple perspectives at once. So it all sort of looks very cubist.
Okay. Wow. Okay. So now the book is, you know, has all these kind of elements of physics and science, but it's also very much about relationships.
Yes.
Family relationships, yes, I... and toxic relationships.
Yes. For me, the relationships are the core of the novel. You can read the novel and read it for like the you can read the novel for the speculative elements and then them going from universe to universe to figure out what is happening and then the people, but for me, what the novel is about is the relationship that Ellie has with her sister Chris and her cousin and her cousin Daniel and the relationship that Daniel has with her boy that Daniel has with his boyfriend Belt and the relationship that Daniel has with his mentor Adi and so you have like these complex of people and then the way that the way that they relate to each other and then the way how to a certain extent how they are a bunch of people that all in one aspect or another have been cast off by other people and have sort of found each other as a family because you get to I should know which chapter this is. I think it's chapter 5. You get to and then one of the things you realize is that Ellie and Daniel are not particularly loved by their own families.
Right.
But they, likewise that you see Adi who is, I joke that he is Obi-Wan Dumbledore, he's Obi-Wan Dumbledore Gandalf. And then he is not necessarily a person who's beloved by the core CORPS of maintainers. But
I actually saw him more as Mr. Miyagi.
Okay. but still, it's a mentor figure. And then they have all found each other, and to me the novel is the crux, the heart of the novel are these relationships.
Right. So you're a microprocessor architect by day. So how does that influence your writing?
Well, with respect to this book specifically, so you can think of the Skunk Works as a large engineering project. Just like the universe is like massive. So the thing that generates this universe, maintaining it is this large scale engineering project. And my day job is essentially I work in a large scale engineering project. So this novel in a lot of ways reflects my experiences. It reflects my worm's eye view of large scale engineering projects. Because I think of myself as sort of one of the workers on the bottom rung. And I'm looking up at this, and I'm looking up at sort of this mass at this massive organization of people needed to execute this massive task, and then this novel sort of reflects a lot of what I've seen and experienced in terms of what needs to happen to execute this massive task.
Okay, and in the novel, you have three kind of workers, basically, that are executing this. You've got the verifiers, the maintainers, and what was the other one?
Okay, the maintainer is a generic term.
Okay, okay.
But there are within them, there are three roles.
Okay,
there are
okay.
There's the architects, who they are the people that go, well, this is what physics is. They basically sort of figure out sort of they sort of basically specify, well, this is how physics should work. Or okay. This is that. You have the verifiers who make sure that they have designed the right thing and they've designed the thing right. And then you have the builders. And then they are the people who actually go into the Skunk Works and then manipulate the valves and then manipulate the reservoirs and then the piping to 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 actually make the machine that generates the physics.
So in this world, physics has a physical representation in this Hogwarts. It's not just designs on paper. It's not rules written down. It's actual, like you said, pipes and valves.
Right. It's actual machinery that is working inside some other universe. So it's this device that actually behaves according to the rules of whatever universe it's in.
Okay.
And then so on and so on.
Okay. Okay.
Because that universe then has its own skunk works, and then so there is this cascade.
And it goes, and it's like a circle. So.
Right. It's like a circle, but it actually doesn't matter for the purposes of this novel. But it's in the text, so it's canonical. Right. But I decided that there are basically an infinite number of universes. But the innermost generates the outermost, so it ends up being the circle.
Okay, and Ellie is, which of these is she?
Well, Ellie is a builder.
She's a builder, and Daniel is a verifier.
Yes.
Yes, and how about Audie?
Well, that's why I joked that he was like Obi-Wan, Dumbledore, Gandalf. Is that Audie is Daniel's mentor, and then Audie can basically do anything. There is a conversation at some point where basically Audie fixes like several bugs in the universe overnight, and Ellie is flabbergasted in part because it happened overnight, so it happened very quickly, and then he did something that normally would have required a bunch of people working together, but he did it by himself. So
and then what are the isolationists?
Okay, so at the start of the novel, the isolationists are the people that Chris used. Chris used the isolationists as a way of scaring Ellie when she was a little kid. Like behavior the isolationists will get you.
And isolationists want what? What is it that they supposedly want?
So when this is, and then you sort of get this in like chapters 2 and 3, which is that, you know, which is that whenever Ellie has worked with her mom to make fixes to the universe, she finds that she gets attacked. She and her mom spend as much time fending off people trying to stop her from making changes as they do actually making the changes. And so at the start of the novel, Ellie sort of puts two and two together. Hey, there are these people that Chris tries to scare me with, and then there are these people that are always trying to stop my mom and me from fixing the universe. So she puts two and two together, and then she says that must be four. These people must be the isolationists.
Okay. All right. But she kind of learns something a little bit different about them as she go.
I'm trying not to spoil the novel.
I know.
One of the arcs through this novel is that she grows to realize how unreliable a narrator her sister is. Because the thing is, her sister is like a decade older than her. So like when she was six, when Ellie was six, Chris was like 16. And if you're six and your 16-year-old sister tells you something, you're just going to believe it. And there's no reason why you wouldn't just keep believing it. But at this point, Ellie is a graduate student. She's a graduate student about to get her PhD. And then she has come to realize things about her sister.
Mm. Yes. although it's very hard for her to admit it.
Yes. Yeah. It's a journey that takes the entire novel.
Yes, yes. Okay, so John, tell me a little bit about your writing process. So you said you started with this short story, this thread, this idea because of when you're missing the train, that the announcement was saying the train was just arriving, and that was sort of the beginning of everything. What comes next? You have this initial idea, then does the world sort of, do you build the world in your head before you start writing, or do you start with character, or what do you do?
Oh, I robbed shamelessly from the improv playbook. I always put it this way. I am a trained improviser. And what I mean by this is I've taken years of training in how to do improv. But trained is different from good. I don't claim to be a good improviser. I claim to be a trained improviser. So a lot of my writing, weirdly enough, is based off of my improv training. Because in improv, you go on an empty stage, you have a scene partner, who is similarly there on the empty stage, and you have literally an infinite number of possibilities. But for the most part, what you are taught is that you and your scene partner already have a relationship. Like, that relationship already exists, and it's up to the two of you to discover what that relationship is. And then perhaps to discover that relationship, you will need to establish some things about the world. And then because you're up on this empty stage, that world can be anything. You can just decide that there's a stove and a table there, and suddenly there's a stove and a table there, for example. and then perhaps that helps you define your relationship. And then that tends to be how I approach things. That I have these characters, and they already have this relationship. I just have to figure out what that relationship is. And in the process of that, I will place them in the world that I need to place them to best show off that relationship.
Okay. So I'm guessing that in the plotter versus pantser, you would be a pantser.
Yes. Yeah. It's kind of funny. I actually outlined this novel after I wrote it.
Okay.
Because it's a process called reverse outlining. Like a bunch of writers whom I love and admire have talked about this, but I wrote the novel and then I outlined it to see, well, did I get everything? If there's anything missing, and then I reworked the novel to some extent based on the outline, but the novel came first.
Okay. Well, that's an interesting process. I like that. So you write it, then you outline it to make sure that it all makes sense, that it all holds together. And then your rewrites utilize the outline.
Right. Did
you find holes when you did that?
Well, I was going to say, because at some point you kind of have to have a structure. And the thing about a novel is that it's large enough that you can't, like the thing that I love about short stories is that they're short enough that you can sort of hold the structure in your head. And the thing about a novel is you kind of can't do that. Mm. It's like this novel is about 67,000 words. So it's not the longest novel, but it's still long enough that you can't really hold the structure of the thing in your head all at once without like forgetting something. So what that was good for was that I could sort of go back and go, oh no, this needs to, you know, this, these things need to happen to set up that other thing. For example. So it was actually very useful in that respect. And also when Jen read it, and like I said, Jen asked me some really excellent questions that led to what are now some of my favorite parts of this book.
Can you give me an example?
So there is a chapter where they have to defuse a car bomb, and 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 what happens is not what anyone would have expected. They're trying to figure out what happens if I do this to the car bomb, and then they discover, well, if I do this to the car bomb, it'll turn into a rhinoceros. and that's a chapter that would not have happened if she hadn't said, you know, just exactly what happens here. Is this something that you can expand? And this was something that I could expand because by then I had sort of understood the structure of my novel. Okay. And I could go, yes, this is the same thing. And then, because she asked that question, I ended up with like this really lovely set piece that is one of my favorite bits of this novel and would not have otherwise existed.
Oh, cool. Do you think that our world is as fragile as these universes are?
As what, sorry?
As the universe in your book.
So when I wrote this book, I'm talking about universes, but I'm really talking about structures and organizations. And then one of the things that I hope becomes apparent throughout this novel is that structures and organizations require constant maintenance. They don't maintain themselves, just because something is working doesn't mean that it stays working. It does in fact take active work to keep them working, and we as a people need guardrails. And those guardrails don't stay up by themselves. Those guardrails have to be enforced.
You aren't by any chance referring to democracy, are you?
And then sometimes the call is coming from inside the house. Sometimes the thing destroying this organization, sometimes this thing destroying, knocking down all the guardrails are within the organization. And if you are in a position to do something, and then, like I said, this is one of the dilemmas that Ellie has throughout the novel is that if you're in a position to do something about that, if you're in a position to enforce those guardrails and to maintain this institution and then basically to keep things working, is that a thing that you should do? And then that is a decision that Ellie has to come to, one way or the other over the course of this novel.
Because the bad guys are wanting to be able to change the rules to benefit themselves. Right. We see that happening in the world today. It probably always has happened. But I don't know. It just seems like it's more apparent right now.
And were you thinking
about that as you were writing this?
The thing I have to point out is this: how long it took for me to write this novel.
Okay.
So to some extent, I guess what I will say is that the novel is not a direct reaction to anything happening right now, because I wrote the novel, like, it's been a moment. I had to write this novel and then I had to find an agent but I was definitely thinking about this sort of thing. Like, if the novel had come out when I had written it, I think people now would look back on the novel and see, he's talking about institutions and how they are fragile, and how there are people sort of trying to subvert the rules or rewrite the rules to benefit them. But it's coming out now, and I think people will look at it now and say, I'm talking about institutions like it's not a direct reaction to what's happening now, in part because it can't be, But, you know, but it's also not a direct reaction. I mean, but it's also not a direct reaction to what's happening now.
Yeah.
Because it's happening. Because it's happening, and it's also what my book is about.
Right. Okay, so how long did it take you to write this?
Oh, God. Okay, I wrote the short story in 2014. It was published in 2015. Then there were a couple of years where like I said, there was this other novel, the less that we are not going to talk about, because like I've become a much better writer. Let's just put it that way. So
that was your learning book. That was your learning novel, right?
But so at some point I waltzed back. So at some point I waltzed back around to this. At that point, it's probably like 2019, I forget. Like, I actually could look this up. I'm not going to. But it was probably something like 2018, 2019. And then there was like a pandemic, so some of the writing happened then, but it took a moment to find an agent. And then there were visions. It is easily years. I just can't tell you how many.
Okay,
but it's been a while.
I gotta tell you something. I'm having this very odd experience of time not quite working right now. It's like it's almost time for our interview to be over, and it doesn't feel like it at all. So what are you doing?
It has been really fun talking to you.
I'm just like, I don't know what happened. I've been doing these hour long interviews since 2006, and normally I have a pretty good feel for the flow of time, and it's just like, I don't know. It just didn't work this time. Okay. So, you said you had to find an agent. Was finding a publisher at all challenging for you?
Well, see, this is why you have the agent. It was kind of funny because he was much more enthusiastic and much more optimistic about me selling this novel than I was. Selling this novel was it was unusually fast. This doesn't usually happen like this. I got a bunch of Insta rejects at 6 weeks, which is fine. It happens. But I got an offer like 5 months after we went on submission, which is like crazy fast. I just want to underline, I recognize how incredibly lucky that was. Normally it doesn't go that quickly. And then I'm actually not sure why it went that quickly. I mean, I don't mind. I mean, I don't
no,
mind.
No, of course not. And your publisher is?
Tor.
Which is?
Tor Books.
I mean, that's who you obviously would want to be with, right?
Yes, we aimed high.
Yes. Wow. Well, congratulations.
Thank you so much.
And this, you said this was your first novel?
Yes, this was my first.
Do you think that the fact that you had been so successful with short stories and novelettes before helped in this process?
Which process, the selling process or the writing process?
Well, both, but no, in finding your publisher.
I honestly can't tell. Because like I said, I got a bunch of rejections that basically started off by I got a bunch of rejections which basically started off by saying, you know, how much they enjoyed my short fiction, which, you know, I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm not complaining. I think that that's great. But I guess my point is a certain amount of short fiction success doesn't like guarantee a sale. Like it doesn't, you know, I mean, I don't think it hurt, but I don't know how, I mean, I don't think it hurt, but I don't know how much it helped. I mean, and I will point out that plenty of people sell novels without having a short fiction track record. So
that's true. Are you continuing to write novels now, or are you going back to short fiction, or both?
Let's say I have a novel in progress, and then there's also a short story that I'm working on at this point.
Okay. All right. And were you, I'm assuming speculative science fiction will be kind of where you'll stay, or do you have any interest in broadening the genres?
I would love to get published in the New Yorker at some point, but I want to get published in the New Yorker for a piece of speculative fiction. So, which they have published. It's
they
not
have?
A,
okay,
like,
okay.
Like I'm not suggesting anything there was a story a couple of years back about the guy who was like the king of amusement parks, and then there was all and I forget there was a different story that actually did involve people leaving in a spaceship, so I'm not actually suggesting anything outlandish, but I would love to get published in New Yorker at some point.
Well, we are out of time, and I want to thank you so much for being here with us today, John. And you know, the book, like I mentioned, was the title is The Subtle Art of Folding Space. I normally say that several times during the interview, and I kind of forgot to even bring it up, and I'm still like kind of boggled that the whole hour went by that quickly. So I look forward to your next book. We do always close with a quote, and I'm just going to do one about the universe from Neil deGrasse Tyson. Not only are we in the universe, the universe is in us. And thank you so much, John.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
All right. And see you all next week on Writers' Voices. Thank you.